Well, we're in Romans chapter 8, and so if you'd like to open your Bibles there to Romans chapter 8 this morning, we're going to get there. For the next 30 or 40 minutes, as we get to Romans chapter 8, I would like to talk about being under pressure. Under pressure. You know, you all know what it's like to be under pressure, right? Anybody not know what it's like to be under pressure? This doesn't need a lot of explanation as far as being under pressure. When I show this picture of this egg in a vise, for some of you, you're like, I can relate to that. I've got a few cracks going already. I can totally relate to that. I know what it's like to be under pressure. And if we opened it up for you to share your story and you felt comfortable enough to share your story, we would be here for probably 3.5 years sharing the pressures that we're going through right now by different examples that we have. So we all understand what it is to be under pressure, right? Here's my question. Is it right to be under pressure? Is it right to be under pressure? Have you ever thought about that? Because, listen, let's be honest. Most of our conversations are spent talking about the pressure that we're under, right? I mean, we call up a friend, we talk to, you know, you're talking to mom, and what do you talk to mom about? I'm under this pressure, I got this thing going on, and let me da-da-da-da-da-da. And you have your sister, your brother, your best friend, and most of your conversations are spent with, I've got this negative thing going on, and it's a lot of our time, energy, is spent talking about pressure. Would you agree? So the question I have, because we all complain about being under pressure, is it good to be under pressure? Is it right? I'm just letting you absorb this. A pregnant pause to give you a chance to think about this. I know the coffee's starting to kick in, right? I'm going to say it's good. I'm going to say that pressure is good. I'm going to say that pressure is right. Why? Look at an infant. This child is 6 months, 8, 9, 10 months, 12 months old, and it's learning how to walk. Isn't it great to watch a child walk, learn how to walk? What do? They fall a lot, right? I mean, they're trying to get up on their feet, and you see them, and as a parent, you're like, pull out the video camera, and it used to be this big thing you put on your shoulder, and we're going to get this, and you plug it in, and you know, get it all set. Now you're like, pull out your phone, and you're trying to videotape this special moment where they take their first step, and you put, you know, duct tape and all kinds of, you know, cushions around all the sharp edges and furniture so that they don't break their head open or anything like that, and you're there sitting there watching as they struggle and are under all of this immense pressure to take one little step. I, you know, my imagination goes crazy sometimes, right? So I was imagining this week. Could you just think about this? If you could go into the nursery and these infants, 6, 9, 12 months, whatever, year and a half, whatever it is, they're all learning to walk and you're in a daycare or whatever, and they're all there and they're able to talk about their day. They're having dinner in their high chairs and circled up and they're having this conversation. You could kind of see somebody doing this on the computer. How was your day? Man, my day stunk. I tried to walk 3 steps. My mom, she was pressuring, she was cheering and all this crazy stuff. And it was so annoying. She had the camera in my face and there I was trying to take a step. I took one and that wasn't good enough. She props me back up on my feet. And I mean, could you see the circle? And oh, you have no idea. I fell down, hit my head. Can you believe that they put me that close to the coffee table? It hurts so bad. I got blood everywhere. And you've got all these different things going on. Could you imagine? Okay, my mind goes crazy sometimes. You know this. But that would be how it would, you'd think it'd be in the nursery. Why do you think that? Because that's what we do as adults. It's a ton of pressure for an infant, but we would say, no, 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 you have to learn how to walk. This pressure is what? It's good. How about an elementary or middle school or high school age child that hates going to school? Hates going to school. That every day is just this terrible pain. I mean, you don't have any kids like this, do you? It's good, I do. You know, and every day is like, oh, I don't want to go to school. I don't like school. And this pain of going, and as a parent, you say, but this pressure, this hardship, this suffering that you're in, I know all day long you have 6 hours and 23 minutes to be there. I know that 6 hours and 23 minutes is very hard, and it's challenging to sit there, but this pressure is what? It's good. And they want to look at you and say, easy for you to say because you're not in it. And what do we say? You have no idea. I've been there and done that. When I was a kid, they had school for 6 hours and 43 minutes. We weren't slackers like you. We walked uphill the school both ways in this, you know, and we go and inflate the stories of when we were young, right? We're like, we know how it is, and we had it worse than you. And they're like, I don't think we had it worse, because the amount of homework the kids bring home today is incredible. I don't remember ever doing homework. I don't think they gave me homework, but I don't. Anyway, that's another story for another day. When you look at an athlete that's training to be in soccer or any kind of sport, football, when they're in the weight room, training for the game, and all the pressure that they put themselves under, the pain that they're in the next day, we would look and say, yeah, but wait a second, no, that's good. That pain, it's worth it, because you won't get to game day if you're not there. The musician that sits at the piano or sits at their instrument and plays for hours and hours and hours just to get a couple measures just right, just to get that feel just perfectly. You would look, and if you have that child at home that's practicing the piano and doing those two measures over and over and over, you're sitting there like, oh man, come on, would you move on already, get to the next phrase? But they've got to get it just right. Why? Because the time for them to perform in front of people is coming, and they want it to be perfect. And you would look and say, you've got to keep pushing. You've got to get through this. You've got to get those measures down. You've got to work out. You've got to be ready for game day. You've got to get through this. I know it's hard. I know the pressure's big, but you've got to get there, right? And you'd empathize a little bit, but the truth is, you would say, pressure is good. Pressure is good. But here's what I'm understanding. In our culture, pressure is something that we don't care for. Why? Because we live in a culture that is all about instant gratification, right? When I go to the drive-thru window, how long do I expect to wait for my food? Like, I'm okay with about 20 to 30 seconds, but much more than that, I'm starting to get antsy. Like, I thought this was fast food, right? I might not say it, but I'm thinking it, and you are too, right? And but you think about all of life, and you remember dial-up? Some of you are too young to know what dial-up is. You know, you click on the button, you sign into AOL, and that's where it started for me, and you sign in, and you walk away and come back 3 hours later, and you're actually on the internet now. You know, today, kids have no idea that, you know, you go and push this button and that one and you're on the internet. They have no idea that and all the other stuff that we went through and the pain of the dial-up. And now it's so instant, and it's just fascinating how it works out now. But here's the thing. Because of all the instant things that are going on, we look at the pressure of life and we say, there's no way I should be going through this pressure. I shouldn't have this pressure in my marriage. I shouldn't have this pressure in my workplace. I shouldn't have this pressure in my finances. It should be solved. Once I think it should be done. Right? Aren't you there? I'm there. I thought about it. Yep, it's a problem. So therefore, it should be done and I'm over. I get to move on now. And if you sit in pressure for too long, like, I'm kind of okay with pressure being there, or suffering being there, hardship being there. In a relationship, I'm okay with a couple days, but if it goes a couple weeks, that becomes like, well, something's wrong. Maybe I don't need this. And if pressure's there in other areas of my life, I begin to rethink and recalibrate and say, well, I can do without. I don't need to go there. And Satan often tempts and says, hey, listen, you deserve better. Satan is there to destroy. He's there to pull us away from God's plan. He doesn't want us to grow. And so he throws these lies in and say, you know what? I know that you've been working at this and this pressure's hard, but I'll tell you what, this guy over here, he's really good. I mean, Rob's got the music down and you've been working at it and he's like 10 times better at you and he hardly works at it at all. And so all the pain and pressure that you put out at the piano, you probably should just quit. I wouldn't do the piano. But you follow what I'm saying? And Satan wants to throw that at you and say, hey, why don't you just quit? They're better than you. They should do that more than you should. And that goes into anything. You get into a job where you're like, man, I don't have the degree. I'm not as good as, and all this other stuff. And Satan is sitting there saying, hey, listen, I'm going to get you now. And he throws discouragement and says, you know, they're better, and you're no good, and you're worthless, and all this stuff. And God says, stop, stop, stop. Here's some truth. I designed you to be where you are, and this is what you excel at. And stop trying to be better than the next person. You just be what you're great at. Be the best you that I've made you to be, and I'll give you grace to do what I've called you to do. It's a total different picture. But he uses pressure to do that. So I've alliterated it for you this morning. Just here's something to totally remember. If you're taking notes, here's something to jot down. You ready? You ready? My message in summary. Pressure prompts progress. Good? You like that, right? Pressure prompts. You're going to remember that. It's PR even. I alliterate it really good. It took me like 3 days. You wonder what I do in my office, right? This is what I do. I'm like, I'm going to alliterate this so that they remember. Pressure prompts progress. To prompt. You understand what a prompt is, right? We get pressure. You get prompted. It's that it's pushing this thing in you that says, come on, let's go. It's a prompt to push you forward, and that's what pressure does. It's a prompt. It does not guarantee progress. You got that? It prompts you. It pushes you in the direction toward progress. It makes that available to you, but it doesn't guarantee that the pressure that you're in is going to result in progress. It just pushes you there. It's the prompt that gets you toward progress. Progress is growth. Progress is going forward. And so that's God's plan. So how, then, do you make it under pressure? We all feel pressure, yes? So how do you make it under pressure? That's what we want to talk about today. Romans chapter 8. You're there with me, right? Romans chapter 8, verse 18. Paul, the writer of this, he understands pressure. He understands suffering. He's been through all kinds of pain. He's in the midst of pain while he's writing to this book or letter to the people in Rome. He is agonizing, wanting to be with them. He's been through prisons. He's been through all kinds of painful situations, and he's writing to them as an encouragement. And he says to them in Romans chapter 8, verse 18, he says, for I consider the sufferings or the pressure of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed in us. He's looking at the pressure, at the suffering, at the pain that he's in, and he's saying, hey, listen, here's the deal. I look at the pressure that I'm in currently right now, and I look at that in view of eternity, and it's nothing compared to that. It's nothing compared to that. Compared to the future as to what I'm going to be experiencing, I understand that what I'm going through today is nothing. It's just nothing. It's like the person that has a terminal cancer. And they meet with a doctor, and the doctor says, hey, listen, this you have about 6 months to live, but here's the thing. And they've had situations like this, and I've been there with people that have been in things like this, and they said, look, this is terminal. However, there's a treatment. This treatment's going to be painful. This treatment's going to be challenging for you. And we're going to have to perform surgery or do chemotherapy or do radiation. But with all of that, you'll be able to heal, and we believe we can get this. And then at the end of this, in about a year, you'll be back to normal, and you'll survive. So then the question is, what do you do? Well, it seems pretty simple. You go through the pain that you're in. Why? Because you look at the future and you say, over here is way worth it. So point number one, if you're taking notes, there's 2 points under this. Pressure prompts what? Good. All right. So pressure prompts progress. And if it prompts progress, here's how you do it. You go through it by looking ahead. by looking ahead. Here's what Paul was doing. Here's how he got through suffering. What was known about him from the very beginning of his life all the way through is that he was a person that God chose to suffer. He was a person that understood pressure. He was under it constantly. And so here's how he dealt with it. He looked at the pressure that he was currently in, and he looked at it and said, it's nothing compared to what the future holds. And so he looked and said, yeah, but down here is healing. Down here is this true hope. And he says this down further, and he talks about this in verse 19 then. He says, for the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope, that the creation itself will be set free from the bondage of its corruption and obtain the freedom of its glory of the children of God. Here, just all together, he's just saying we're all suffering together. We all have pressure in our lives. We are all going through all of this together. We get this. And he's adding a lot more, but for sake of time, I'm not diving into every little nuance that he's saying. Verse 22, for we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. When do you get through pain? When does pain start? When does pressure begin? At infancy, childbirth. The first thing the doctor listens for when a child's born is what? Crying. They're like, oh, this is so uncomfortable out here. Could you imagine a child talking, you know? Right? What is going on? You know, and anyway. See, my imagination is just all over the place. He says, we've been groaning together in pain of childbirth until now. All of life is spent under pressure, and we all understand this. We can all relate to this. We've all been there. He says, and not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit grown inwardly as we wait eagerly for the adoption of sons, redemption of our bodies. So here's what he's saying. Here's the reality is that while we are here in pain, we are waiting for a day that there is no pain. Isn't that cool? It's going to be over someday. So when? Where's the hope? And he says this several times. I underline in my Bible. This is great to do. You underline different things. Several times throughout these verses, he has this word hope. If you underline each time, you have like 6 or 7 times that he mentions this word hope. He says in verse 24, for in this hope we were saved. In this hope, what's the hope? The hope that Jesus Christ has come and he has paid for the sins of the world so that those that put their faith in him have everlasting life. They have nothing to fear. They're absolutely secure. So by putting my faith in Jesus Christ, not in religion, not in coming to church, not in giving to church, not in being a nice person, not in being better than somebody else, but putting my faith only in Jesus Christ, I then have this hope that at the time of my death, I will enter into the presence of God in a place called heaven. And at that point in time, I will have a new body that all of a sudden I will not be suffering with pain. I will not have any hardship. I won't be lonely. I won't be struggling. I will all of a sudden have a totally brand new, awesome life where I'm not worried about this life any longer. And we should be saying, can't wait for that day, right? That's hope. I'm waiting for it. I can't wait for this. This is the time that I'm anticipating. I'm looking forward to. And he says, so while you're going through suffering, here's the picture. I'm going to be looking forward. I'm looking ahead. I'm looking at this place where I say, this is where I have my true hope set. This is where my faith is. And I understand that at the time of death, I'll be with him. So this pain right now is worth it. It's worth it. So I go through suffering, I go through hardship, so that I come before God then, and I hear from him, well done, good and faithful servant. Did God understand any of the suffering? Yes or no? Yeah. How did he understand it? Yeah, Jesus Christ. Did Jesus go through anything worse than what we're going through? Did he go through loneliness? Did he go through rejection? Did he go through physical pain? Was he broke? He didn't even have a bed. He didn't have a house. He didn't have anything. He did all of that for us. to pay for all of our sin, so that, not simply to pay for our sin, so that we can have a relationship with God that is forever and ever and ever and ever more. But there's so many that reject God and say, nah, there's got to be a better way. I think that God's one that you have to work your way in there. Or I think that he's just going to let everybody into heaven. And it clearly says over and over and over that he sent Jesus to pay for the sin, that those that then put their faith in Jesus Christ alone will spend eternity with him. They have that awesome assurance. And so that's the push. That's how we get through the suffering that we're going through, the pain, the pressure. That's how we make it through that. Years ago, many years ago, when I was in, I think it was 9th or 10th or 8th grade, somewhere in that range, I was playing soccer. Now, I like to play soccer. I was playing with the teens on Wednesday night downstairs, and I didn't push too hard because I didn't want to be too winded afterwards, but I was sweating like a crazy man. But anyway, I still like to play soccer, and I'm okay at playing soccer. But some of the guys, like Noah, pulled this move on Wednesday night that was really cool. He kicked the ball up and with the other foot, and he just missed like kicking it into the goal, but it was sweet. I mean, I was there. It was awesome. But when I was in 8th, 9th, 10th grade, I'm playing soccer, and the coach comes over to me. He says, hey, listen, Bill, you got to get your head, your eyes, off the ground. He said, all you keep doing is you keep looking at the ball that you're kicking around. You're looking down. He said, you got a lot of crazy skill going on here. You can kick the ball, you can juggle the ball, and you have great control of the ball, but that's all you ever look at. You can't see the defenders coming in to get you. You can't see around you at all. You're not looking around at all. You're not looking forward. You're not looking ahead to see who you need to be passing it to. Because I have you on left wing or I have you on right wing. And here's the thing. You're supposed to be going up and you're beating this defender. And you're so busy looking down, you can't see where the center forward is. You can't see where the center half is. And they're getting ready for you to kick the ball into where they are so they can score the goal. You're so busy looking down, you got to look up. Man, that was hard. Like, but how am I going to control that? You got to work at it. You have to have that ball in such control, and you got to be able to look around and keep your eyes focused on everything, all the things that are around you, so that you can look forward to hitting that goal in. It's the same thing. We look ahead. We look forward. We are looking with anticipation instead of looking down at the pain I'm in and just kind of dwelling in it and saying, oh man, my life stinks because I've got this sickness, and my life stinks because I'm broke, my life stinks because nobody likes me, my life stinks, and Satan wants us to be right there and just look down, and you got great ball control and you can kick that around and you're juggling just perfect, and the enemy's coming in to attack while we're looking down, and God is saying, no, stop looking down, look forward, look forward. I've got a goal for you that's waiting for you if you were to simply be looking forward. The person that I see doing this in such a tremendous way in the book of Genesis is Joseph. Oh, man. This guy had a life. At 17 years old, he gets this dream about how he's going to have his brothers bowing down to him. He goes to his brothers, and I would do this too. I'm from a family of nine. And so I'd go up to my brothers and they'd say, hey guys, guess what? One day you're going to be bowing down to me. It's going to be the coolest thing ever. And here's what they would do. They would beat me up right there. You know, that would be it. And so that's what they did with Joseph. They take him out and they're like, we got to get rid of this guy. Let's kill him. No, we don't want to kill him. So let's sell him into slavery. And so they make some money off him, sell him into slavery. Good day or bad day for Joseph. I mean, he was just being a punk, right? That's all he was being. Like, I'm going to tell them. And here he gets sold into slavery. He's in slavery. And so then he does his very best. He's like, okay, I got to stay focused forward. I got to just look ahead, and this is where I got to be. And I want to please God, and God's doing this special thing in me, and I don't know what it is, so I'm just going to keep looking ahead. And so he does, and while he's doing that, he's giving his very best. And Potiphar, the guy that's in charge, like a chief of police or the mayor or whatever, he's got him there, and his wife, Potiphar's wife, lies about him, or makes this accusation. Oh, he keeps trying to come in, and he's trying to put moves on me and stuff like this. And he even what happens to Joseph? Gets thrown into prison. Good day or bad day for Joseph? I mean, he did his very best. Why isn't God blessing me? I've been doing my best, and I even got all these promotions as a slave, and I'm the top slave, and now I get thrown into jail, and I didn't do anything wrong. God, I'm trying to honor you. I've given you my life. I've surrendered my life to you, and I've got all these people around me that want to do me harm. And now he's in prison for how long? Years. Years. Forgotten about. He interprets a dream. The baker, they forget about him, and he's there. And just through the hardest of lives, he continues to look forward. He continues to be looking ahead. He's continuing to keep his eyes focused. While Potiphar's wife is tempting, here's what he says: I'm not going to sin against my God. I haven't forgotten who I'm looking forward to being with. I'm not going to stop looking ahead. And so here, as he's in prison, he's doing his very best, and he gets to be the top prisoner. I mean, what a great promotion. What would you like to put on your plaque in the office or at home? Top prisoner! I got the award for 2016. I'm the top prisoner. Yeah, really? That's just not anything worth being noted. But here's what he was doing. He was saying, I'm looking ahead and following my God. And my faith is firmly fixed on what God would want me to do. While I'm in a painful situation, while I'm under all of this pressure, I'm giving my very best for him. That's it. And so he gets to the end of his time there, and he interprets this other dream, and the Pharaoh brings him out, and then he gets reunited with his brothers. And this is the fascinating point. As he gets reunited with his brothers, they say they're in fear, right? Because here's the second in command that could put them to death, right? And he looks at them with absolute forgiveness and compassion. He looks at them while they did all of this wrong to him. They put him in all this pressure and all this pain. He looks at them and said, guys, listen. While you meant this as evil, you were trying to hurt me. I get it. God had a bigger plan. God had a great thing for me. The pressure was good. Pressure was good. Blessed be God. The pressure that we're in is good. The only way to get through is to look ahead. To look ahead. Too often we get overwhelmed with the pressure that we're in and we just focus and look down. Stop looking down. Look ahead. Look ahead. Second part of this text then. In verse 26, I could spend a lot of time on this. It's so rich. It says, likewise, the Spirit, God's Spirit, the Holy Spirit, the Spirit, helps us in our weakness. For we do not know what to pray for as we ought, but the Spirit himself intercedes for us with groanings too deep for words. I love this. While we're going through pressure, and I can't even put it into words, while we're in pain, while we're suffering, while it's hard where we are, here's what the Spirit does. He intercedes for us. He goes to God on our behalf, and he says, hey, listen, Jeremiah over there is going through a lot of pain. You got to give him encouragement. Hey, listen. You've got to be with Bob. He's going through all of this pressure with his business. You got to encourage him. You got to be there for him. And he's interceding for us in God's will. He's not doing anything against God. He can't because he is God, right? So he's interceding for us in words that we can't even understand or express ourselves. And some would take that and put that into a kind of a tongues kind of a thing. I don't put it there. I just put it as it's just a groaning that the Holy Spirit expresses for us that we can't understand. He is just going far and above our own ability to care for us. That's awesome. While we're in pressure, God's praying. Really? He loves us that much. While we're in pressure in our marriage, while we're in pressure in finances, while we're in pressure at work or wherever it is, while we're in all of this pressure, the Holy Spirit is saying, I'm praying for you. That's just amazing to me. With groanings too deep for words in verse 27, and he who searches the hearts, who knows what is the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints according to the will of God. So he intercedes according to God's will, knowing that just as an infant is in pain and struggling and under pressure trying to learn how to walk, sometimes we're under pressure learning how to do this, and God's saying, this is good for you to be under this pressure, and I know you need encouragement. You need a mom to be there and say, come on, it's okay, Johnny. Take the next step. Get up. Come on. That's where the Holy Spirit is. In verse 28, probably one of the most famous verses. And we know. We have this confidence. We can be assured. There's a guarantee here. We know that all things. How many? all things. Oh, by the way, I skipped a part. We know that for those who love God, all things work together for good. I have this confidence that everything that's happening to me, because I love God, everything that's happening to me, God has a plan for. It is good. The pressure's good. The hardship's good. I don't like it, but it's good. And I know that God has a plan. God's not made a mistake yet, and he's not going to make a mistake because he's God. So the pressure's good. We know that for those who love God, all things work together for good. For those who are called according to his purpose. So we understand that God is working everything out for his glory and his plan to bring about the right things for us so that we can grow. Why? Pressure what? Prompts progress. Come on, say that with me. Pressure prompts progress. Right? And that's where we have to be focused, in that God's saying, hey, listen, I've put this in here so that you can be growing closer to me, so that you can be growing out of the bad habits that you're in, so that you can be growing and be a blessing to those around you. And God continues to work in those ways in our life. So then he works this out in verse 29. For those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those whom he predestined, he also called. And those whom he called, he also justified. And those whom he justified, he also glorified. Paul says in another text, in Galatians 5, he then says, as we are called, here's one of the things as of our calling, is that we bear one another's burdens. So the Holy Spirit is interceding, and he is working on our behalf. He's talking on our behalf. And at the same time, he's then bringing in a group of people that care for each other. That's called the church, the called out ones. And the church is supposed to bear each other's burdens. It's supposed to care for each other in such a significant way that we feel the presence of God through the people of God. And so here's my second point. Don't do life alone. Don't do life alone. You got that? You know, the sad thing for me is I watch as we try to do life alone. I'm notorious for this. I figure out ways when I'm doing things, like physically I'm doing work around the house, I figure out ways to do it by myself. Instead of calling somebody and saying, hey, can you come over and give me a hand with this and make it a lot easier? Anybody else like that? Okay, there's three or four of you. Okay, there's probably a lot more. You just don't want to admit it. I'm not like that. A lot of us probably are, where I just want to do it myself and I don't need any help. God didn't design us to do life alone. God designed us to do life together. 2 Kings chapter 6. You want to turn there with me? I think we have enough time to do this. It's phenomenal. In 2 Kings chapter 6, in verse 8, I'm going to just read and explain the text. It's verse 8 through verse 23. So this is going way back. This is before Jesus. This is a history of Israel, and this is after Israel was broken up into two different parts, the northern and southern tribes. And so in 2 Kings chapter 6, verse 8, it says, once when the king of Syria was warring against Israel, he took counsel with his servants, saying, at such and such a place shall be my camp. But the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are going down there. And the king of Israel sent to the place about which the man of God told him. Thus he used to warn him, so that he saved himself there more than once or twice. So he's mind reading, basically, and telling, here's what's going to happen. It's fascinating. God's just using the prophet of God that way. Verse 11. The mind of the king of Syria was greatly troubled because of this thing. And he called his servants and said to him, will you not show me who of us is for the king of Israel? And one of the servants said, none, my lord, O king. But Elisha, the prophet who's in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. Isn't this cool? He's got a video camera that's taping you while you're talking and making plans as to where you're going to go. There's no spy, but this prophet of God, this man of God, knows the next step that you're going to take. So who's the enemy? Elisha. We got to get rid of, we got to black out the cameras. We've got to get rid of the spy that's in, but he's not here. He just knows because he's a man of God. So we got to kill this guy. Now, Elisha's about to go through a bad day, right? He said, go and see where he is, that I may send and seize him. It was told him, behold, he is in Dothan. So he sent there horses and chariots and a great army, and they came by night and surrounded the city. So here's Elisha, sleeping away, doesn't realize that he's surrounded. If you're surrounded by an army, is this good or bad? It's bad, right? You ever feel surrounded in life? You ever feel like you're just locked in and the pressure's all on you and you're just like, oh, I can't get out. I don't know what's going on. This is so aggravating. I don't want to be here. And could you imagine as he opens the shades, as the morning comes up and he looks out and, whoa, we got a problem out here. And for many times, that's where we are. When the pressure's on, we look out and we're like, wow, we're surrounded. There's no way out. This is going to be awful. I can't imagine what's going to happen here. And that's exactly where Satan wants us to be. When the servant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. And the servant said, alas, my master, what shall we do? Elisha, the man of God, says, do not be afraid. Are you kidding me? Did you see my bank statement? Did you see what they put on Facebook? How can I relax? I'm stressed here. There's no way this is going to turn out good. We're surrounded. You catch that? You might not say it as loud as I just said that, but in your mind you're screaming at times, aren't you? He says, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Now, if I'm the servant, you know me, my imagination is going crazy here, right? If I'm the servant, I'm like, Elisha, what'd you have to drink last night, man? Like, are you seeing double, triple, what? It's just me and you in this house. And I know in Dothan, there's not a lot of people. We don't have more than that. I saw that. We're surrounded. We're dead. There's no way. Elisha's just so relaxed. And, hey, pass me the creamer, the sugar. I could go for a cup of coffee right now. And he woke me up all early for this crazy thing. There's nothing to be worried about. There's more that are for us than those that are against us. The servant's like, huh, what? How's this going to turn out good? So then he prays. Maybe he sips a cup of coffee. He prays and says, oh, Lord, please open the eyes, open his eyes that he may see. So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. This is God's army. This is God's army. Isn't this good? God opens his eyes, and he looks around, and he sees all of God's army that's surrounding. And he's like, come on, man, you want to have a cup of coffee with me now? They got this. We don't have to worry. God's in charge. He works all this out. We love God, right? He will work this out for good. He's got a plan for this. I know we're surrounded, but God's got a bigger army than any army on this planet. Man, I see people wigging about our country right now and all the things and all the stress that's going on. Listen, God's army's bigger, right? Why are we wigging out and going crazy about politicians and all the people that say all this, that, and the other thing? Listen, we got to trust in God alone. That's it. Not get all discombobulated with all the mess that's going on around us. This mess is normal. The creation groans because of the sin around us. The creation, our country, is going to be in pain because of things that we're doing against God. Yes, but God's still God. And he's not done yet. His army's bigger. So he opens up, and I love this. He's not done yet. For some of us, listen, here's a quick application. Some of us, we need to open our eyes and see what God sees. We need to open our eyes and see what God sees and stop looking at only the things that we can see. So, verse 19. Or 18, I'm sorry. And when the Syrians came down against him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, please strike this people with blindness. So he struck them with blindness in accordance with the prayer of Elisha. Isn't this funny? Like, what did he raise up against this army? Hey, God, can you just strike them with blindness? They'll never find me if they're blind. They will have no idea what to do if they're blind. And God strikes them with blindness. And Elisha said to them, this is not the way. So he comes out to this army, the enemy, that wants to destroy him. He says, hey, guys, this is not the way. This is not the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek. And he led them to Samaria. So he says, hey, listen, Dothan's all right, but here, why don't you follow me? All right, sounds like a plan. Let's follow this guy. He knows where to find the guy that we're after. He's the guy that they're after. And he's leading them down to the other place. And so he takes them to Samaria. And there's a whole lot of context here that I'm just kind of skipping out on. But it says, and as soon as they entered Samaria, Elisha said, oh, Lord, open the eyes of the men that they may see. So now the guys that were chasing him, now they've got to open up their eyes. And the guy that they had on the wanted poster is right in front of them. Problem. So the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw, and behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. And as soon as the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elijah, my father, shall I strike them down? Shall I strike them down? And he answered. Now, here's the thing. You've got this little group now that was this huge group, because all the people that are the enemy are now around them. They're nobody now. They were the bullies, and now they're being bullied. So shall I strike them down? Shall I kill them? I love what he does. He answered, you shall not strike them down. Would you strike down those whom you have taken captive with your sword and with your bow? Set bread and water before them that they may eat and drink and go to their master. Here's what I want you to do. Set out a feast. Have a big dinner with them. With our enemy, really? Yep. Yep. Set out a feast. It's going to be okay. Remember last week we talked about that, Psalm 23? He prepares a table before us in the presence of what? Our enemies. Look, he's doing it right here. I'm going to prepare a table before you in the presence of your enemy. So they set bread and water down before them. They ate and they drank. So in verse 23, they ate and they drank. He sent them away, and they went to their master. Now what do? After they ate, they shake hands. Hey, good meal. That was really great and spot on, but we're still enemies, right? Sure, whatever you say. Verse 20, the end of the verse 23 there. And the Syrians did not come again on raids into the land of Israel. Isn't this awesome? See how God solved this one? The man of God said, hey, listen, listen, listen. I know what you see, but let me tell you where God is. He's not done. God's bigger than all this mess you got around you. I know you're in this pressure, but God's bigger. And he wants to do something mighty in you. You see, you can't do life alone. The servant needed Elisha to share that with them. The servant needed his eyes to be open. In this church, here's why we're doing what we're doing. We're building a ministry here. It's called a small group ministry. Why? We're building groups of people that we can get together and we can talk about life and talk about what God's doing in our life. And it's certainly directed, but it's for discussion purpose and it's for relationship building. Why? So that we can be connected to God in such a way that we were not connected before. So that we can have Elisha's come into our life when we're in the midst of pressure and say, Lord, would you open their eyes? They're not seeing how big you are. And sometimes, listen, we're all there, aren't we? There's a lot of times where it's like, I don't see how this is going to work out for good. And God's like, I got this. I got a plan. I'm going to work this out. And that's why we're doing this kind of a ministry. And I believe this is going to be, as we continue to pursue God in this, as we continue to keep him at the center of this, I believe that this will be the backbone of God growing this church ministry. And so that's why we're pushing and encouraging people to be there. And I know right now we're not doing a ton of like outreach events and things like that. Here's why. I would like to build the infrastructure inside and get people, get us in here more focused on God so that as we bring other people in here, we're solidly focused in on him, not just a social club that people come and say, well, they're kind of cool. Make sense? Because our goal and agenda is for us to turn our eyes on Jesus and as other people come in here, to turn their eyes on Jesus as well. And so that's what we're doing right now. It's a lot of stuff that we're doing in the background, but I believe it's going to be great. It's kind of like if you're doing a race car, you build the race car before you go to the race. Make sense? So you're like, I don't understand what that is. That's all right. Talk to John. He'll tell you all about it later on. So, by the way, in BSM, the teens, they're excelling at this. on Wednesday nights, it's awesome in that we are doing small group, we're doing some teaching, and then we're breaking up into, right now, two groups. And last year we had four groups, now we're doing two, and then we're going to break out into four. And the discussion time this last week, and I'm loving being back with the teens. They don't know this, but I secretly really enjoy this. But hearing their discussion and dialogue about real stuff is incredible. Man, don't do life alone. Don't do life alone. That's not where we should be. So here's what I want to do. I want to close out and land the plane here. Ready? I want to show you a story that touched my heart. And I think that it captures what I've been trying to say in this message. So if you've missed everything, maybe this video will grab you, and then I'll wrap it up.
Redman, the best form he's shown since he broke the British record.
When you try your best but you don't succeed. When you get what you want but not what you need. When you feel so tired but you can't sleep. Stuck in reverse. Tears come streaming down your face. When you lose something you can't replace. When you love someone but it goes to waste. Could it be worse?
Redmond has broken down. He's on the track.
Will guide you home and ignite your bones, and I will try to fix to let it go. But if you never try, you'll never know just what you were. Lights will.
This is 24 years ago, in 1992 with Derek Redmond. And you can YouTube and you can watch several different renditions of this story where he goes to do this 400-meter race. And he's 27 years old. This is the last time he'll be able to do this in Olympics. And as he goes around, he's not quite at the halfway point. His hamstring goes, and he can't make it. But he gets up with incredible courage and tenacity and says, I'm not done yet. I want to finish my race. I want to finish my race. I'm not quitting. I'm not giving up. I'm not done yet. And man, some of us need to hear that today. I'm not quitting. I'm not done yet. I'm not finished. God, keep working in me. And here's the amazing thing that God does. Just like the father come jumping out of the stands, comes up the security guard. The security guard's holding him back. And what'd dad do? You're not holding me back from my son. I'm going. And he pushes past the security guard. And what they didn't show you on the rest is, I watched several different versions of this. And what they didn't show you on this one is that as they went down, they had several officials come in and try to stop him. And the father, I mean, you could see the meanness in his face. He's like, leave me alone. My son and I, we're finishing this race. Our Father in heaven comes along as an intercessor and says, listen, I'm holding you up. I know you feel broken. I know you feel hurt. I know the pressure is all on you. And I'm going to help you get to the finish line. Just keep getting up. Just keep getting up. Listen, maybe you need to hear that today because you've been saying, I'm going to throw the towel in. I'm done. I'm hurt too bad. I can't get back up. God wants to work mightily in you to keep you going. Will you let him? Will you let him? Will you let him? Let's pray. Oh, God, for some who maybe we've thrown the towel in at different points, Lord, I pray that we'd pick the towel back up and get back up in your strength, in your power. And keep going. Lord, you're not finished with us yet. You're the author and finisher of our faith. So God, I pray that you'd give us the strength, the tenacity to keep pushing. Lord, when the things are the pressures got us down, God, I pray that you'd work mightily. Lord, help us to see the armies of the Lord that are all around us. Help us to see your plans that are greater than our problems and pressures. Oh God, help us to get back up. We give you the glory. We give you the praise for the strength that you give to us. In Jesus' name I pray.